welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and professional speaker, bringing you interviews, inspiration and information on writing, publishing options and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free Author 2.0 blueprint and lots more information at thecreativepen.com, and that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hi everyone, I'm Joanna Penn from thecreativepen.com. It is the 21st of March 2014 and this is episode 180 of the podcast. Well, today I have a brilliant interview with Nathan Massengill all about graphic novels, and I don't know, it's one of these areas I know nothing about. Well, I do now because I've done the interview, but you know, I love movies like Wolverine and X-Men and all that. So I know, you know, Hellboy, stuff like that. And I know all of that comes from comics, but I don't read them myself. Although when I go into Foyles in London, on Tottenham Court Road, which is a brilliant bookshop, really massive, they have a really good graphic section, and I do find myself kind of reading there quite a lot. And just, it's a form of creativity that's stunning, because in my head when I write, I do see things. I don't know about you, but I'm a visual person and I do actually imagine the action and things around, and I feel that the graphic novel way of portraying a story is very close to what's in my head, and yet I don't have the skills to communicate in art, you know, in drawing or painting or whatever. So anyway, this is a fascinating conversation and I think you're going to really enjoy it, whether or not you know anything about the graphic novel industry right now, and even if you write nonfiction, I think you'll really find this an interesting discussion. So that's coming up. And in industry news, exciting news this week, Nook Press has finally opened up to authors in the UK and several countries in Europe. And so finally, after, gosh, it must be nearly, well, at least 3 or 4 years, we've been, you know, publishing on the Kindle as non-US citizens, but finally Nook Press has decided to go for it. Now I immediately jumped onto Nook Press and found that although it seems reasonably easy, it kept hanging and I'm having a bit of a nightmare. The EPUB formatting is just crazy. It's so funny because now I do EPUB formats at iBooks, Kobo and Nook. Kobo is by far the easiest site to use in terms of formatting. I mean, really, I've had no issues with my EPUBs at Kobo, but Apple's been a crazy nightmare, and now it looks like Nook is going to be a nightmare as well. So yeah, I mean, I think I'll talk about publishing direct onto all of these platforms at another point, but I'm now direct on, well, I will be on Nook soon anyway. But anyway, if you want to do, if you want to publish on Nook and you are outside the US, go and check whether your country is now enabled, because there was quite a list of them. So I do have almost all of my books on iBook Store. The only one I haven't managed to get there is Career Change, because it's got some formatting issues and it's driving me nuts. But the rest of them are now on iBook. So if you do read on iBooks, Pentecost is free and A Thousand Fiendish Angels is free, as they are free on Kobo and Amazon as well. So I would love for you to download that, even if you don't want to read it, because I need to get moving in those areas. So that would be fantastic. Okay, on other book news, The Deadly Dozen, the mystery thriller box set I'm in, is excitingly in the New York Times list for the second week and USA Today for the third week. So that's really cool, because it's great not to be a flash in the pan. And, you know, it's easy enough to spike. Well, I say it's easy enough. It's obviously possible, let's put it that way, to spike your sales for a short time. But in order to have sustained continuing sales, you know, there's other work involved. Although what we have found is once you make it into the various top charts, and we're top 100 in the US and top 100 in the UK, is that the sales do, you know, sell themselves essentially. So that's quite cool. I have done a long blog post about hitting the lists and my lessons learned, so I'm not going to go through it in detail here, but you can read that on the blog. I posted that this week, so that will be in March, or you can just go onto the Creative Pen and search Deadly Dozen or New York Times list and you'll find that. But basically, one of the big things that you guys should realise is that you need sales in more than one store. So if you are KDP Select, you won't hit the New York Times list. If you are, if you're only selling on Kindle, you won't be able to hit the list. If you're not focusing on selling in multiple stores and they don't report, you won't hit the list. So you kind of have to have this baseline number of sales in a number of stores. So there are no exact rules published, but if you scroll down to the bottom of the New York Times, you will see what they say. And it's something like, I've put it in the comments of that post, sales from exclusive stores will not be reported or something like that. So that's interesting. Second lesson learned is really that collaboration and relationships are important. Obviously, this was a box set of 12 authors, and so the initial relationships, and I certainly didn't know all of them, but relationships and being known are important for this kind of thing. Deciding on the goal before marketing. So clearly, if you've seen the Deadly Dozen, it's a sort of 99 cents. It's not about the money, but it was more about hitting the list. So I will be doing other projects to make more money, but the point was there to get on the list. And if you know your goal, then you'll be able to decide on your marketing beforehand. So that's important. So for example, if your goal is to get to number one on Amazon.com, not hit the New York Times list, then you know you can just focus all of your energy there. And finally, building your email list is so important. And I still get people come to me and say, how do I build a list? And there is a blog post on the site that tells you how to do that. And also, our main aim is to be able to hit the list on our own, which, as I, you know, whenever I've been scrolling through, I find H.M. Ward, Holly Ward, and Barbara Freethy and Bella Andre, who seem to be able to hit the list on their own now just by sending an email, which is entirely based on email. So, you know, building an email list so that when you have a new release, you can send out the email, people buy the book, yay! So those are kind of some things for you guys to think about. On my own writing, I'm about halfway into Day of the Vikings and going down my rabbit hole of Norse mythology and, the prose Edda and all these kind of interesting things. And so it's fascinating because, I'm also reading Game of Thrones at the moment still. It's obviously very long. I'm towards the end of book three at the moment. You see all of these things that obviously George R. R. Martin has been using the myth, and even and obviously Tolkien. So reading the prose Edda, I find all these notes about Tolkien doing this, that, and the other. Oh, and that reminds me, there was a lovely piece in one of the blogs about a publisher releasing Beowulf with Tolkien's notes in, which I think is a brilliant idea because I love Beowulf, and obviously Tolkien's notes would be pretty cool. I've also started on my next non-fiction book about the business of being an author, which is going to be, it's really interesting. After 13 years as a business consultant, I bring, I guess, a different viewpoint than many people. So I'm writing that, and one of my author friends said to me, no one's going to want that book, you know, it's all written in business language. And it was like, yeah, but I think it's important that we learn this kind of language and understand that this is a business like any other business. You know, you need customers, you pay suppliers, you need cash flow. You need to look at your profit margins, you need to look at your marketing, you need to do, you know. So anyway, it will be interesting to see if anyone actually wants the book. But I have started it, so that's cool. And it's also interesting because as I'm writing it, I'm doing kind of process flows and thinking about how my own work is going and how I am pretty much at breaking point most weeks with the amount of stuff that I'm doing myself. And which is funny because I can actually see how outsourcing the publishing to an appropriate publisher is a good idea. So that's interesting. But the question is, who's the appropriate publisher? That is the issue. And, you know, if you want to change things on the fly and all of that. So anyway, I am considering my own process flows and how much I can potentially outsource. Okay. So that's pretty much where I am right now. Oh, I should also say, if you are listening to this reasonably soon after I recorded it, there I'm doing a Scrivener webinar, which will be a free hour on how to use Scrivener, and you can sign up for that. Basically, there is, well, because it's so short term, I don't really want to give the URL. But if you are listening to this before Wednesday, the 26th of March, there's a blog post on March 25th, which will be all about Scrivener, and that will have a link to the webinar. So you can go and check that out. And that will be an hour's free webinar of all kinds of tips for writing in Scrivener and publishing in Scrivener. And I'll also be talking about a brilliant course Joe, a friend of mine, another Joe, friend Joseph, a friend of mine has done, which is fantastic and much easier to learn how to use Scrivener with. And you can find information about that course at thecreativepen.com/Scrivener. So yeah, anyway, I will, let's get on with the interview. Here is a little note from Kobo Writing Life. The podcast is sponsored by Kobo Writing Life, of course, and you know, I am a huge fan, as I say most weeks. So here's a short message from them.
Hi, Creative Pen listeners. This is Mark Lefebvre, Director of Self-Publishing and Author Relations at Kobo. Wanted to tell you a little bit about Kobo Writing Life, which you can find at kobo.com/writinglife. It is the free do-it-yourself platform for getting your books published into Kobo's catalog. One of the reasons why you may want to log in directly to Kobo Writing Life rather than coming through a third-party aggregator is that it gives you tighter control over your books. One of the things you can use for tighter control is the ability to set your price in 8 different currencies, take advantage of pre-orders, and schedule price promotions. Lots of great opportunities available for Kobo Writing Life, and you can learn a little bit more at kobowritinglife.com. And now back to your host, Joanna Penn.
Hi everyone, I'm Joanna Penn from thecreativepen.com, and today I'm here with Nathan Massengill. So, welcome to the show, Nathan.
Thank you very much.
It's
an honor.
It's great to have you on the show. Now, just as an introduction, Nathan is the author and artist for the Viscera graphic novel series. His comic credits include Wolverine, X-Men, Batman, and other New York Times best-selling comics. He's also collaborated with notable creatives, including Joss Whedon on Buffy and also with Christopher Nolan. Now, just uber famous, Nathan. That's an amazing list of credits.
No, it's comics. It's comics.
I know, but within the world, I mean, comics have this amazing audience, right? They're fans of comics are uber fans.
Yeah, they really are. I've often said, and I just came back from a convention in Pensacola where they expected 3,500 people to come at the most. And around 15,000 ended up showing up. They had to turn them away. It was more people than had ever been at a convention in Pensacola before. So this is a big change from when I started in comics, when you were very lucky to get, you know, 100, 200, 300 people. The fans are growing. The online world is expanding it exponentially. And comic book fans are incredibly loyal, kind, supportive, generous. They're the best, highest quality fans any author could hope for.
That's amazing. So, yeah, you talked a bit there about starting. Can you just tell us a bit more about your career and how you've progressed?
Well, I since kindergarten, that's all I've ever done. When I got out of high school, I went 2 years to a technical school run by Joe Kubert called the Joe Kubert School of Art that actually trains comic book artists. And I got to work with Joe Kubert there, one of the great legends in American comics. And it was a wonderful experience. And from there, as soon as I got out of school, I started doing small jobs. And about 1992, I worked on my first Wonder Woman comic book, who happens to be my favorite superhero character to this day. So, and I've done it ever since.
And how about the difference between working on comics and then working on things like Buffy? I mean, I guess, you know, you've got to think of me as not knowing anything. How does that progression work?
Well, Joss Whedon decided a wonderful thing, you know, since Buffy on television was canceled and everybody wanted the series to continue, obviously, including Joss Whedon. He decided, you know, why don't we continue the TV show in comics? So he did season 8 and season 9 of Buffy as a comic book. And it's really been amazing to see a TV show live on in a way that otherwise, you know, it would just be a piece of history already, and still it's going on. And I got to work on just a little bit of season 9. And since Joss Whedon is one of my favorite creators, it was great to work on his project. And I love Buffy. I think Buffy is one of the great characters in cinema.
Yeah, absolutely. That's amazing. And you mentioned Wonder Woman there as one of your favorites. And of course, your comic, Viscera, is a female protagonist, very kick-ass. What is your attraction to the strong female character?
Well, you could probably answer that as well as I could with your wonderful characters. And I think, honestly, I find female characters as leads to be much more interesting. We see a lot less of them. I think there's a lot more you can do with them dramatically, especially in combat situations. And it just is something that we see a lot less of. I enjoy them more. I would watch when Hercules and Xena were on at the same time. I'm a Xena guy. I was watching Lucy Lawless as Xena. And I have always felt, you know, that the female leads were strongly underrepresented, and I've naturally always written strong female leads.
Mm. And, I mean, I guess the impression with most of the women in comics is they have kind of large breasts and small waists and quite, you know, and isn't it the chainmail armor? Is that the kind of stereotypical...
Yeah, comics, especially in the 1990s, went through this long period of extremely, you know, sexist depictions of the characters. And strangely, although the depictions were sexist, often the characters themselves, beyond the rendering and the rendition of the characters, were actually kind of unusually dominant and powerful. They weren't weak or submissive. They were very strong, but the drawings themselves were very sexist in the way they were just portrayed. But then again, as many of my fellow artists have pointed out, you know, we don't look like Superman either, and, you know, we're not complaining about it. So that's my friend Adam Hughes always says that. And, you know, so the everyone in a superhero world is extremely extreme in their physicality. Viscera is in that range because of the particular theme that I've chosen, and she's kind of... people are supposed to expect one thing from her and get entirely the opposite. So it's kind of playing on that paradigm of what you see is not always what you get. And I think that it's very interesting. And comics are changing a lot. Usually they're at the forefront of, cultural changes, particularly related to women. And I hope they'll continue to go forward in that. Although, there are some notable misses.
Yeah. Well, no, it's interesting you say that because I, you know, my character, Morgan Sierras, I kind of see as my alter ego, you know, of course, is perfectly proportioned and can fight and can do all these things. It's kind of near a superhero. So we all, and I don't complain when, you know, Thor takes his top off.
No, I haven't heard any women complaining about Chris Hemsworth.
So I mean, yeah, I mean, sexism in lots of things, you know.
In fact, I think the beauty standard was pretty much reversed in the Avengers movie. That everybody was going to see the guys, and you know, and the Black Widow, as awesome as she is, and the actress is Scarlett Johansson. She was overshadowed by her male leads, which is something very unusual and not unwelcome, just different.
Mm. And just on that, with the gender balance, I'm wondering, with actual comic book artists like yourself, is it a male-dominated industry?
Well, it's that was the thing when I was growing up, and when I started in the business, you would go to a comic book convention, and there would be absolutely no women there. I'm not talking about maybe one or two or three. None. And if one did walk in, it was the wife or the girlfriend of the guy who was, you know, dragging her along. And she was very uncomfortable because everybody was looking at her and like, what is that woman doing here? And, you know, well, you know, everybody was just, and nobody likes to be looked at and singled out and stared at. And particularly since I think women are finding a greater access to comics. Anybody can now go to Amazon and download comics and be involved in it. And we've finally been able to disprove, you know, a lot of the things that the big bosses think about what women want is obviously completely idiotic and usually absolutely wrong. And it turns out, you know, women can like the Avengers, you know, and the old thinking was that women would never like the Avengers, and that you couldn't even have female leads in comic books because who would read them? Guys won't want to read that, and women won't. Well, they weren't in the audience at that time. And now I think women make up a significant portion of the readership, and it's growing all the time. And it's revolutionized comics, and it's made it really a lot more fun to be involved in comics.
Fantastic. And sort of conventions like Comic-Con would be the famous one, right? And everybody kind of dresses up. All yes. The pictures seem to be men and women now. It just seems to be a lot yes. of fun. Do you dress yes. up at these conventions?
Oh, no. Nobody wants to see me in a Thor costume. Or you know, it's not going to happen. No. I leave that to the experts. The cosplayers are amazing, and they brought a lot of fun to a convention, and some of the costumes they create are better than movie-quality costumes. It's really amazing, and everybody has fun. And women are feeling more and more comfortable at these conventions, you know, even though they get a lot of the same flack they get in the world outside. You know, I hope that, you know, the comic book community and the fandom for science fiction and fantasy will continue to be more and more embracing of the cosplayers and, you know, people that just go to have fun and have a great time.
I must say, I would really fancy dressing up in some of this stuff. It does look really, but just very expensive, to be fair.
Yeah, they spend so much time on these things. They build the things from scratch, and they have it's like a whole lifestyle. And I can't imagine. I would never want to dress up as any character at all. But I admire it. I'm always stopping people who are walking by my table to run out and take a picture with them. I admire it so much, and the enthusiasm. And you know, it's an incredibly exciting environment to be in. And I just, like I said, conventions today are nothing like they were in the past.
And I wonder, I mean, what do you attribute the, I mean, it really is mainstream now, you know, Marvel, and I mean, the movies we watch, a lot of these blockbuster movies are superhero movies now. You know, I think recently I watched The Man of Steel. I mean, I love explosion movies, so all these movies, I really love The Avengers. I mean, Wolverine was fantastic, you know.
Hugh Jackman, yeah. Yes. Women like Hugh Jackman for some reason. I don't know why.
Oh, shirt off fight scene. I mean, that was the best. With swords, dangerous stuff.
It's amazing, yeah.
It was amazing. But why do you think people just want this, you know, want the superhero stuff? I mean, what is it that is wrong with our society that we want that?
Well, that's a very interesting question. I think that, and it's something I've thought about a lot because, you know, I loved superheroes when I was a kid, and I just assumed, you know, I would do the same thing. I'd find girls and you know, get interested in cars or sports or something and just grow out of this crazy phase. But I really never stopped liking superheroes because they changed. Around 1986, when I was at that, you know, 16-year-old period where I'm like, okay, I'm gonna switch out, Alan Moore's comics started coming out. The Watchmen came out. Frank Miller's The Dark Knight came out. And there was a renaissance of comic books, which were revisionist, that they didn't follow the old scripts, where people suddenly began to take it seriously, began to listen to what Will Eisner and the original generation of comic book artists were saying comic books could be. And you know, people stopped burning them in piles, calling them the devil's literature and all that stuff, and they just grew up along with me, and so I've constantly found something new to be interested in. You know, what the reasons I was interested in Wonder Woman have changed over the years. As you know, you begin to think about what a character like this means. If you're a feminist or into feminist theory, and you look at Buffy, and a lot of Buffy fans have a great time saying, "Is she really feminist? Is it really a feminist series? And is Wonder Woman really feminist? And if not, why not? Where's the miss? Where's the disconnect?" And so you can really bring that kind of analysis to these power fantasies. But people love them because everybody wants to be able to do what a superhero does. You like the explosions and people making the explosions. You like Morgan Sierra because, you know, what other people would only think about doing, she just goes out and does it, you know, and she's not afraid, and she's smart, and she's pretty, and she shoots stuff, and she's just great. We, you know, and who doesn't want to do that? I mean, it's a lot more fun than reading, you know, a book about, you know, politics or something. Who cares?
I totally agree with you. And I also think that, I mean, a lot of these characters have the dark side, and they are complicated characters. They're not just simple anymore, are they? They've all got this dark side. And also, they, you know, there's a battle and an overcoming. And I mean, all the great character creation is in these superheroes, really.
It's true. I mean, they come out of, you know, they come out of myth, modern mythology, the modern symbols of mythology have come out of comic books. You know, everything from Superman's S to Batman's bat symbol to just, there's a million iconic images that have come out of these myths. And everyone is, humans have always loved myths and ideas of things bigger than ourselves, beyond ourselves, to get out of our ordinary common world. Mm-hmm. And, you know, comics came out of, you know, Pulp Fiction, which was really dark and really harsh. And they came out of that world, and it imbued all that material. And up until the 50s in America, comic books really had a lot of roundness and depth and thought put into them. And then, of course, the government censored comics, effectively censored them and shut them down. Thank you, McCarthy. And they were kind of, you know, after that point, put in this little image of, this is a child's literature, you know, and they're only beginning to recover from that, you know, in the past few years. And now people take them very seriously, thanks to some very pioneering creative individuals, you know, who've outlived that vicious censorship.
Yeah, no, I would agree with you. And so just getting into the more kind of technical side of things, what do you actually do? So do you write stuff type stuff, and then do you draw with a pen and paper or on a computer system, or how do you actually work?
Yeah. I do all the different aspects. I've always wanted to be a writer-artist, which is a kind of a rare combination of creator like Frank Miller, who writes his own material and draws it as well. But typically comics are broken up into some subcategories, like a band is broken up into subcategories. A lot of my career has been spent as a finisher or an inker, where I'm kind of a part of a team that's creating a book. And other times I've been fortunate to write something or color it or letter it. All the different aspects I've enjoyed doing. It's just very interesting. But it's broken down into a lot of little minute technical lingo and subcategories and, you know, small little kind of very small teams to create the book, but they're almost always created by teams of people.
Mm. But if people want to have a go at drawing, I'm just thinking of like, because a lot, your viscera looks like it's hand drawn, but I presume, is that hand drawn or is it drawn on a computer
program? Viscera is definitely hand drawn, although there are computer elements to it. The genre right now is moving more and more digital. More all of the color that you see in the mainstream books at Marvel, DC, and Dark Horse, almost all of it is going to be done on computer. And the lettering, there used to be, you know, people who made their living doing hand lettering for comics. Now, and people make their living doing digital lettering for comics. And so, a lot of the process, even a hand-drawn kind of organic-looking book like Viscera, is going to have computer elements, and so you sometimes you'll draw it on you know, on your little drawing board, and you put it on your scanner and you put it in the computer, and then you think, oh my gosh, there's a million ways I can improve this, so it's a very integrated process, and a lot of people are doing it many different ways. I can do Viscera entirely digitally and never touch a paper, but I feel like with that particular book was very experimental in its style and very organic, and so I was really interested in minimalism and just going back to very simple simple style, black and white only, no grays, nothing, and just seeing how little information I could put on a page to tell the story, to make it more immersive for the reader. Us crazy artists, we think of all that kind of stuff. You do the same thing as a novelist when you're thinking of, you know, am I going to make a really flowery description on this page, or is it going to slow down the narrative pace so much? Artists think of exactly the same thing. When I listen to your podcast and the authors are talking about things that go into novels, it's surprising how exactly similar they are to the artistic process or the process of writing a comic.
Because, of course, you might have one line of dialogue or maybe no dialogue, and you've drawn a scene with a background, a backdrop, a physical setting, and an action. So you almost don't have to say a lot. You just have to draw it.
Right. And there's an old saying in comics, show, don't tell. And I think it's a great rule for novelists as well, you know, that it's a lot better if you can suggest what your hero is doing in a kind of parallel narrative or a parallel idea, rather than just saying, now John is angry. You know, in the comic book, you show them as angry. You know, Hulk breaks a wall down and you know he's mad. So, I mean, it's a lot more fun to see him break the wall down than to say in the caption, Hulk angry. Well, that's kind of fun. But you know what I mean. And so with a comic book, you're juggling like these multiple narratives. There's incredibly long sequences in Viscera where I have almost no dialogue. And I have that opportunity to move the reader through that scene, much like you would with quick shots in an action movie. And, you know... And so it's a lot of fun. And then when I'm getting into these like intimate moments, you know, where they're sitting by a fireside and they're talking, you know, I just switched it all to text, because that's a data dump. That's a time when, okay, you can skip it as a reader. Or if you're really interested in the kind of, you know, fireside chat, which I think is one of the best parts of the book, then you'll sit down and you'll be immersed in the dialogue itself and not distracted by the two people sitting around talking, which is a very thing to – it's an easy thing to shoot in a movie. It's a great thing to write in a novel, but it really, really sucks in a comic book, because, you know, the last thing you want Hulk to do is sit at a bar and talk with the other Avengers, you know, and then the camera goes back and the camera – you know, you don't want talking heads in a comic book. And that's one way that comics are very different than films and novels and everything else. There's things that you can do in the medium of a comic book that you can't do in any other medium. and it gives you all kinds of creative license and unlimited special effects budget, just a really you get to work with if your artist is very good and he can make your characters act and he can bring your setting in and make you feel like you're really in China or really on the moon, you know, then you as a writer can really cut back on what narrative you need to put in place and really just focus your words on that one iconic idea. Alan Moore will often write a story in his dialogue that's absolutely separate from what you're watching in the background, so that you have this incredibly textural and visual experience that sometimes merge and sometimes move forward, but it's never replicated. You know, he's never saying in his dialogue or in his word balloons what you're looking at, because they never need to be replicated.
It is absolutely fascinating. It really is. And then in terms of actually producing and distributing a comic, so once you've made it digitally, how are things working now with print versus digital? How are you getting work out there, and how are others getting work out there?
Well, it's again been a real revolution, very exciting time. Because, you know, there was a huge barrier before the internet world. There was an incredible barrier, particularly to color comics, something you would have to order to get any kind of really great reproduction, or really to make it cost effective, you might have to order 20,000 copies. You know, now there's wonderful print-on-demand publishers, particularly my friend Barry Gregory, who runs a company called Kablam, KABLAM.com, and he will print a color book at the same cost. He will print 100, he will print one, and you know, he will send them, you know, just like the other print fulfillment orders, but they're as good as books run on an offset press. They're beautiful. Every book he takes care with, and you know, so you might run your comic book for a dollar or two, you know, and you know, one copy at a time. So an author can invest in a color comic and not have to have, you know, those classic boxes of books sitting around. And even comics can do that now. And that breaking the color barrier that way has been great. And of course, the digital revolution is even better in a lot of ways. As it's expanding, the devices are getting better and better at displaying them. And so I'm hoping that comics will get out of the you know, boutique market they're in and come back into the forefront of literature the way the movies have done for comics.
So, I mean, I've read about Kindle Comic Creator, which is a new thing. Do you know anything about that?
I did put Viscera into the Kindle Comic Creator. It was a really interesting process because it, particularly with Viscera, has a very unconventional experimental panel structure. Panels are the little boxes that you read to one at a time. And I spent a lot of time like shooting the book. Like I would create where the panel goes and overlap the panels so that there's a kind of cinematic experience almost for the book. And I ended up like some things even worked better in the Kindle Creator than they work in the book. But it's awkward because, you know, I think a lot of the things that Kindle Comic Creator is doing now is like it's difficult to say, but it's kind of compensating for the lack of resolution and the lack of screen size that's still there. The next generation or two of devices, or the larger devices presently, are going to really change that idea. The Kindle Comic Creator, instead of displaying the whole static page, will zoom in and give you a guided panel view so that you'll switch from one panel to another. It took me 3 days to set up those panel views. 3 working days, very long days, and it was very interesting, but it is not a simple process, and especially for a one-man shop, it's not terribly easy, but it was satisfying to do and very interesting, and the software is great. Anybody can do it.
Anyone with 3 days and is a comic man like yourself. But I guess what it does show is that Amazon believe that comics are a market, otherwise they wouldn't have done this.
Comics are a huge market. The comic book print market, even, which people have been proclaiming dead since about 1996, is resurging. Comic book print market in 2012, I believe, resurged 12%. So it's coming back even. And the digital market is expanding exponentially every year. We still have a lot of issues of comics being kind of segregated off in a different distribution chain than novels. One of the things that I've enjoyed listening to your show for is because, you know, you're talking about how to put, you know, novels into the digital distribution chain, how to get noticed, how to get brought forward. But for comics creators, it's very difficult because we're even in a submarket of a submarket. So I've been really interested in seeing if I could apply some of the rules and guidance that you so generously and brilliantly bring forward on your show and apply that to a graphic novel. You know, I haven't achieved success at it yet, but, you know, the process is still ongoing. And I'm really interested in getting out of the submarket and seeing if there's a way to bridge novels and graphic novels. I think it's something that novelists should really – I'd love to see those markets integrate. And a lot more novelists do graphic novels, and a lot more graphic novelists do novels, and maybe even make hybrid editions, really kind of supplement. I mean, there's a lot of potential to do novel and innovative things and expand novelists if they would go and you know, make graphic novels out of their novels. Hey, you know, that's an extra market, extra piece for your market. That's something brand new that you can, even though it's the same story that you've already invested all that time in writing, suddenly you've got a new product. And everybody that loves your book is going to want to read the graphic novel. And people are going to read the graphic novel that didn't read the novel. And there's no other way, I think, that a novelist or graphic novelist could reach a completely different market. There's not a lot of crossover between the comic book market and the and the novel market, but the fans of both are extraordinary. And it's like, I think that the more these markets merge and the more people consider there to be very little difference between a novel and a graphic novel in terms of what they will buy, the better it will be for both genres.
Yeah, I mean, when you think about, I mean, when I write, I think about it as a movie because I love the action movies. And actually, I mean, it's such a tiny percentage of people that will ever see their books as a movie. But realistically, a graphic novel is kind of the closest you can get, really, isn't it? Yeah,
it is the bridge. A lot of people view it as the bridge. A lot of I know a lot of directors now, major directors, who are saying, you know, if you want me to read your script, make it a graphic novel, then I'll look at it. They won't even look at the print scripts anymore. They're pulling all their work out of graphic novels because if you think about it, the graphic novel is a movie that's already way down the line. I've done a small article on my website about this, so maybe I can go into more depth on it there. But it's like a novel is an enormous work of imagination to translate into film. But a graphic novel is already, the sets are built, all the characters are cast, you know, the complete world is designed, all these elements are there, the pacing is there, the storyboards, the all-important storyboards are there. And the difference between a storyboards, which directors shoot from, and a graphic novel are really not that different. In fact, it's usually comic book artists and illustrators who are doing those storyboards for the director. So it's like already their movie is moved five steps forward, and they can really see it. They can see what's wrong. They can see what's right. They can see what they can improve, which is probably great for them because, you know, they're going to look forward to changing things around. And so I think it's the gateway between the two. It's particularly hard to get it's easier to get a novel read than a screenplay, perhaps. Because directors just have piles of them, it's a lot easier to pick up a graphic novel. You can look through it in a few seconds and know if you're going to like it or not. You can't do that with the screenplay. You can't do it in any other way. It's very, very appealing to time-strapped people in Hollywood.
Okay, so now I'm really excited, and I'm sure lots of people listening are also excited. So if people want to work with a graphic artist like yourself, you know, because most novelists or writers are not going to be able to do this on their own because you need an artist. So how would people find and work with graphic artists who are up for doing this kind of thing?
Well, the article I've done on my website covers a lot of this, but the basic thing you want to do is you want to, you know, if you know a comic book artist, ask them who's good, who's available. I do a lot of consulting work. People often, you know, write me and say, you know, I've got a novel. Is it a good graphic novel? I have a friend of mine. He's a brilliant novelist, and he'll often bring me his concept, and I'll say, no, that's not a novel. That's a graphic novel, and he'll completely write his novel in that form. And I'll say, what you have is primarily in your novel visual. Therefore, you know, it's gonna play better and quicker and be more immersive as a graphic novel. So you can go to a consultant and really decide whether or not your book is appropriate for a graphic novel. Whether if it's a lot of just talking heads, you know, then you have worries. But if you have action scenes, if you have sequences, if you have a mystery that involves a lot of visual elements, if you have you know, a celebrity bio or a techno thriller, all these things make fantastic graphic novels. And so you should go to a consultant, and they will recommend you to an artist, who always go with somebody that has experience doing comic books. Just a graphic artist, as you say, will not necessarily be a good comic book artist. A comic book artist is a subspecialty of a subspecialty. It's one of the hardest and most difficult fields of all commercial art, because you have to draw so many panels so often. You have to be able to draw everything in great volume very quickly. And so you want to go with an expert, with somebody who's done it, has a proven track record. And you know, so that's why you want to talk to people who've done it and get linked up with somebody. But if you do that, and it's not that hard because it's the online world now, you know, you can find an artist who's excited about your work, who gets it, who has this style, and you can have this mutual admiration society of people, and you can get it funded pretty easily. You know, if your book, I would say, if your book is already successful, say you published your novel and it sold over 3,500 copies, then I think you should definitely begin to consider making it a graphic novel. If you're over 5,000, yeah, you definitely should have one. Why not? And if you're over 15,000 in sales, it's a no-brainer. I mean, you've got to do it, because you should have the fan audience to easily crowdfund it and get it done. And it's just going to expand the amount of difference it will make, I think, to a novelist audience is incredible. It gets you into comic book audiences. You can merge your fan base with an artist fan base. You get these great fans that you've never had before. You can, all important, add to that catalog. You've talked on your show so often about getting to that magical number of books. And graphic novel, you can put one right in there. You know, you could make deluxe editions of your novel bound with the graphic novel in a digital world. So many possibilities.
Mm, it really is. And I mean, you mentioned, really, we're talking funding. So we're talking Kickstarter, things like that. And I don't want people to think it's easy, because, I mean, I've always shied away from Kickstarter because, you know, even I've been online for a while now, but I don't feel like I would doubt that I have the, you know, a big enough audience. I think we all feel this, you know, sort of worry that it wouldn't be there. So if people do want to do Kickstarter and get funding, what sort of funding level would we be talking about for a graphic novel?
Well, that's a tricky thing. I think that, and it's tricky because when you go with Kickstarter or Indiegogo or some of the others, it's not only Kickstarter. Each one has different, you know, different attributes and different value and different accessibility levels. Particularly with Kickstarter, you have to have an Amazon account to make that contribution. So for people who are contributing to it, it gives them a little bit of a barrier, you know, for which reduces their ability to impulse purchase. So it's very different in terms of which crowdsource to pick And it will depend on, you know, what incentives you're offering and how you want to your time frame, how quickly you think you can raise the money. But you want to look at, let's say we want to create a 64-page graphic novel, which usually will – you can get a lot of novels condensed into a 64-page graphic novel. And you've got to consider when you're doing this that your artist is going to spend a very long time doing this book. So they need money to do it, particularly if they're not getting a split of the creative rights. There's a lot of issues that come into this. Hopefully that article on my website will help people really access this idea. But you want to look at what it would cost them per page. Novelists work on advances, you know, where you'll get from a traditional publishing company an advance for your book. And comic book artists work on page rate. So you want to figure out, okay, what do I really need to pay my artist per page to do this? And then you would multiply that by the amount of pages, and you begin to need to figure out at that point, you know, what you will need to clear to get your book done in a reasonable amount of time. That's the way to get the book funded. Getting it into print is relatively very simple. You can usually that's not the difficult part. The difficult part is the patience it takes to get it done, and the page rate, you know, to get it produced. It's a different process than working on a novel. It usually will take the artist longer to do the graphic novel than it will take the writer to write the novel. I know novelists who can write three novels in the time I can do a 64-page graphic novel. So, you know, especially if it's in color, if it's in this beautiful painted color, there's a lot of artists' prices and needs will vary. So, but I would look at the number of pages versus what your artist will need to spend as close to full time as possible working on the book, because that's what it's going to take. You can't just casually do the art on a graphic novel. It's a big process. You can shoot a feature film in a shorter period of time than it takes to do a graphic novel. But
yeah, I mean it is pretty major. And just a question on rights. I mean, it's fine if, like me, you self-publish and you own all the rights. But if people have signed contracts with people, what is the subsidiary right that graphic novel would come into? So if they've sold print rights, have they sold graphic novel rights, or does it come under multimedia? Or do you know about that side of it?
Well, that's an excellent question, and there's a lot of legal considerations to be, especially when if you're negotiating with a traditional publisher or you're negotiating with anybody where there's rights issues involved. I would highly recommend that you reserve to yourself the graphic novel rights or the adaptation rights, or negotiate it with your publisher, because believe me, they'll want to have a say in that. And it's very important that that the graphic novels and other types of media adaptations, webcomic adaptations, audiobook adaptations, all these things need to be spelled out in any legal contract. It needs to be spelled out in a legal contract between the author and the artist, you know, because the artists are doing a lot of original designs, a lot of things. And so if it's going to be a work for hire arrangement with the artist, that needs to be spelled out. If there's a certain percentage of creator rights that are going to switch or change hands, that needs to be spelled out. It's something that has to be looked at every level and every detail, in order to avoid misunderstandings. It's better for everybody. But it's not that complicated. It just needs to be addressed directly.
Yeah, I just wanted to raise that because I know some people listening to the show have sold some rights. So it's just a question that is important.
And when you're looking, if you're a novelist working with a traditional publishing house, they may be very interested if you approach them in adapting your novel to a graphic novel, and they may be able to provide the funding for that themselves. So they may be interested in doing that. So it's well worth approaching them and saying, look, I got a great artist who's willing to do this. We've got to figure a certain percentage of the sales we've already made, we can definitely make with this graphic novel. All the ancillary benefits, the increased benefit and likelihood of the book being translated to film. A lot of traditional publishing houses, HarperCollins is working with Neil Gaiman and graphic novels. And those are big business. So they're definitely worth definitely worth talking to traditional publishers about it. And indie publishers, self-publishers, you know, they still have these, you know, these issues to address with whomever they're going to subcontract or work with as a partner to do their graphic novels.
Wow, it's so interesting. And we could talk forever on this. I have so many questions, but we're running out of time. So just tell people a bit more about Viscera.
Viscera is my attempt to do an actual feminist superheroine. You know, since Gloria Steinem put Wonder Woman on the cover of the first Miss magazine in 1972, I believe it was, you know, people have been looking for what a feminist superheroine would be. What would she look like? What would she do? And Viscera is my attempt to create that character. She's in the mold of Sarah Connor from The Terminator, and also she's got a lot of Elizabeth Salander from The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, a lot of punk sensibilities, and she's fighting the rape culture. I figured if a feminist superhero is going to exist, what is she going to fight? What is the front line of the feminist struggle? And I thought, well, it's they've been the ones that have named what rape is. They defined it and began to fight for those rights, you know, in the 60s and 70s. And I think that's what a feminist superheroine would do. What Wonder Woman would not come to man's world to bring hope to it. She'd come to destroy it. She'd come to say, okay, it isn't a man's world. This is a world for everybody. And so Viscera is a very dark story. It's a story that comes with trigger warnings. And it's about a very dark subject that is, I think, suitable to a feminist philosophy, where feminists are always having to come out and say things nobody wants to hear. You know, they don't want to hear that stuff. And it's not a book designed by the rules, which you often discuss on your show. I broke most of them, knowing what they were. But it was a book written out of passion rather than out of some sort of desire to create a bestseller. I know it will never be that, you know, but other projects hopefully will come along that will sell more. But some people have been kind enough to say that it's meant something to them. It's dedicated to survivors of violence, and I think more people need to speak about it, particularly more men. And so it's not an activist book. It's a paranormal thriller. It's you know, really dark, experimental. And hopefully people will like it.
Yeah, and I think enjoy is the wrong word. I mean, it's not a light-hearted, enjoyable kind of read, but it's in terms of the fact that I like, you know, women who are kind of, you know, I like writing violent women as well.
Yeah, there's a with a superhero, there's a great cathartic relief, you know, because she gets to fight this rape culture directly. You know, she can stab it. Yeah. She can stab it in the chest, you know, and kill it, you know, whereas people in the real world, you know, it's much more shadowy. It's much more difficult to get a handle on. And so I think in that sense, hopefully it's a cathartic, you know, release for people. And it does have humor in it.
Yeah.
And really the great trauma that the tension may build up is really never going to happen. Viscera is always five steps ahead of everybody around her. She's smarter. She's 4'11", 89 pounds, but you wouldn't want to mess with her. She will have outwitted you long before you entered the room. And so she has that kind of that's the source of her strength, is she's always got tricks in reserve.
Fantastic. So where can people find you and also the Viscera comic online?
Well, my website is nathanmassengill.com. And that's the site anybody can get in touch with me if they want to talk more about graphic novels or how to adapt any of their work. Ringrunning.com is Viscera's website, and people can access the article that I mentioned through both sites.
Fantastic. Thanks so much for your time, Nathan. That was amazing.
Yeah, thank you so much for the work you do. It's very inspiring.
Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes at thecreativepen.com/podcasts. You can also get your free Author 2.0 blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at thecreativepen or find me on Facebook at thecreativepen. See you next time.
Thank you.